modulation. Is there any amplitude modulation? Is there any 2PXK or 16 QAM? Or is there any other kind of non-angular modulation taking place with that IBOC over you, Eric?
No, it's purely angular modulation.
That's a good trick to get full deviation of analog, essentially full deviation of digital, mix the two together on the one single carrier coming out of that transmitter, and I can get full volume without exceeding the instantaneous bandwidth. That's a very good trick, Eric, go ahead.
That is a good trick, and that's why it doesn't work so well. That's one of these. Actually, you can think of it as two transmitters. There are some systems that are actually two transmitters, where the center frequencies of the two digital signals, the one that's upper and the one that's lower, you can think of them as having their own oscillator on those specific frequencies. And you can think of your analog FM as right smack in the middle.
Okay. I have heard multipath distortion on an FM analog signal. And I'm pretty far from the station, and I'm in an environment that's got a whole lot of reflecting objects. When I'm using these digital techniques, how well does it survive multipath? If I'm out in the fringe area, how well does it survive multipath without giving me crazy kinds of distortion and, what's the word, squiggles? Do I hear anything non-ideal coming out of that loudspeaker in a multipath long-range environment with these digital techniques? WR, KQIW.
KQIW is
okay.
IBOC handles multipath a fairly reasonable degree, but the way the receivers are manufactured, there's an EBNO number, an error rate number, that if you exceed that number, it flips back over to the analog. So if you happen to be listening to, say, CBS FM in digital, and you hit a bad spot, or you hit really horrible multipath, it'll flip back over to analog. And if the multipath is really that bad, you'll hear it there too.
If I'm tooling along with my automobile and it's a reasonably well-designed FM receiver, and by way of the analog techniques, I'm listening to stereo. There's slightly different audio coming out of the left-hand and right-hand speaker, and I'm listening to that in analog. And then the receiver flips over to the digital mode and gives me essentially the same program with the stereo and digital. Will I hear an improvement in signal-to-noise ratio? Will I hear any improvement at all when it flips from analog to digital? Over to you, Eric, KQIW.
KQIW, K2 again. It'll be like taking the cotton out of your ears. It'll be like going, walking from outside with this noisy, all the street noise to a perfectly clean, quiet environment with excellent fidelity. Although it depends upon the bit rate of what they're sending you. With voice stuff, they have a tendency to produce the bit rate to give you more room for the music effect.
Okay, so as long as I'm above threshold for the digital system, I'm hearing I'm going to pick a number, 60 dB of signal-to-noise ratio. Whereas with the analog, unless I'm right alongside of the broadcast station, I don't always have that high a signal-to-noise ratio and that high a frequency response. The 15 kilohertz of audio is not going to sound as clean in analog at a reasonable range. Is that roughly true, Eric? K2IW?
That's roughly true, but consider this. You've listened to a CD in your beautiful stereo. You played the song in MP3, and if you're an audiophile, you're going to know the difference. Well, the digital transmission of audio, including your TV set, by the way, is a form of compression. Now, we typically, like in the TV set, we use Dolby AC3. You can also transmit DTM, but nobody does that. You can, but we just don't. It takes up the same amount of room. The same thing happens on the digital radio. They're transmitting MP3, depending upon the content. And it is a form of psychoacoustical compression, so there is some funny stuff going on that Only an audio file can pick up.
In the major metro areas across the United States, what percentage of the FM stations are putting out simultaneous digital? Is it 30%, 50%, 80%? Give me a very rough guess. KE2EJ, KE2RIW.
KE2RIW, KE2J. It's probably on between 60 and 80% in that neighborhood. All the big money stations, the big network stations, they're all doing it. It's the little guys, like one of the FMers that I take care of. He doesn't believe in digital and refuses to even go near it. So, there are those that have their opinion.
If I buy a reasonable American-made automobile, or maybe even a Japanese-made automobile, in the last 5 years, which has a built-in FM AM radio, are essentially all of them equipped to receive these digital signals? Eric, go ahead.
Nope, it's an option. You can buy it.
Okay. If I don't buy it as an option, do I not get it with almost any car that I buy? Go ahead.
I'm not in the car business, so I couldn't tell you. But there's a manufacturer that provides you with an iBox radio, you know, standard. But I do know that you can go into any showroom and say, I want the digital version of your receiver, or I want your satellite version of your receiver. So you can get it either with the HD radio, or you can also get it with the Sirius XM.
Okay, if I'm not interested in satellite, if I'm only interested in digital, terrestrial, iBox, and I buy it as an option, roughly how many dollars does that add? Does that make the radio in my car $100 more expensive?
You're really asking the wrong person. I don't sell cars. But it's really not that much more expensive.
As far as the radio itself is concerned, it's probably more one integrated circuit that's plugged into an empty space on that motherboard. Is that about the way it's actually done?
Slightly more complex than that, but that's basically it.
Okay, we got a little bit far left of center of what Joe was originally asking, but let's see if he's happy with what he's heard. The A2RYY, the guy that got us on this channel to begin with, A2RYW, go ahead, Joe.
Okay, very good discussion. Very good discussion. I think I got the answer I was looking for. You can go on to the next contestant.
Our next contestant, as you call it, is KD2CX. Hey, Craig. Go right ahead, Craig. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. It's Craig, KD2CXK. Welcome to the I'm sorry, I'm on your net. Okay, well, we're actually going to bridge both nets a little bit today. Eric touched on it a little bit, and I'm glad that he didn't go full tilt into it, because that's going to be stealing my thunder. Anybody who's been keeping an eye on things knows that HF propagation has been really terrible the past few weeks. Some people even say it's been terrible the past few months. We didn't have a real spectacular solar cycle 24. It was a double peak cycle, which is not uncommon. However, one thing that was a little uncommon about it is that the second peak was larger than the first peak, which is not usually observed. Another thing that's very uncommon is there's been a dramatic lack of solar activity over the past 3 months, and there's been no sunspots reported for the past 13 days. I'll let it drop. And what's even more upsetting is that we are not even headed into the deep solar depression, which is due to arrive at the bottom half of 2018, where solar activity is supposed to be virtually non-existent. NASA, JPL, and several other predictions are actually calling for a solar flux of very close to, if not zero. This has never been observed before. The last time there were no sunspots for 13 consecutive days was back in 2010, but we were not headed for the minimum solar flux at that time. so it wasn't really considered all that troublesome. My question to you, and to anybody in the group who cares to join in, is as myself as an HF enthusiast, what do we do? We're about to head into uncharted territory here as far as propagation. The noise floor is quickly coming up on 40 and 80, approaching S8 where I am, and propagation is terrible. And this is only going to get worse. And there's actually a double part of this question, but I'll let you get a chew on the first one, Dick. This is KD2CXK back to net control.
Yeah, the overall question you're asking is, what do you do? And I guess you pray a lot. That's a joke. You read all the articles and what the prediction for the sunspot cycle is likely to be. And I guess when you're saying, what do you do, I guess part of the implied question is, do I put up a whole lot of hardware in the backyard with real kinds of fancy antennas to get maximum performance out of what the sun's going to be giving me? How many antennas, how many antlers you put up in your backyard is really a function of how much room you've got, how enthusiastic you are, and no matter when you put them up, at some time you're going to get a chance to use them. On top of that, the best expert in the world, as I see it, as I hear it, only gives you data that's about as good as your weatherman. I mean, this last snowstorm was supposed to be 14 inches on Long Island, and we probably got closer to 4 inches in many places. So predicting the weather, whether it be the real climate, or predicting what the sunspots are going to do on each individual day, and what is 20 meters going to be like, and what is 432 going to be like, and what is 10 gigahertz going to be like. Let me drop it. There's always a degree of non-predictability. As such, if you have the enthusiasm and the resources to put up some really fancy antennas, even if you can't use it immediately because the sunspot cycle is not supporting it, I would go and do it anyhow. I, for one, own a radio tower, and I get a lot of psychic income. I get a lot of positive feedback of having that radio tower, and I can plaster antennas on it all over the place if I want to, and I get a real good view of the horizon. And as a microwaver, altitude really makes a difference. If I can make my antennas clear the trees, I get a huge performance improvement on 10 gigahertz, for instance. On 20 meters, I'll admit that clearing the trees doesn't give you anywhere near as much performance as how many feet above the ground, the main reflecting surface. And those trees are 90-some-odd% transparent at 20 meters. But if you've got the resources, put up the hardware, and you're always going to get the non-predictability of that propagation as I see it. Let's see if other people who are... I'm not an HF person. So hopefully there are some HF people listening, and they've got some opinions on Craig's original question. So give us your call letters right now, KQLIW in the TechNet. Yeah, maybe the question wasn't proposed in the right format, the right vocabulary, that other people want to join it yet, Craig. KD2CXK, to refine his question, KQLIW in the TechNet. Do it, Jack. Go ahead, Eric.
It's interesting. What I read earlier, actually you'll hear it on the Newsline tomorrow, but I'm looking at the space weather and the Solar Ham website. He's absolutely right. There's no sunspots visible for the last 12 days in a row or so. But there's a couple of areas that... there's a couple of regions where they're expecting some spots to show up. So it's as you said, in terms of it's like predicting the weather. Even the K numbers are real low at the moment. So I do a lot of HF from the car because I haven't really put my it used to be in Astoria, but a lot of HF stuff going. And it's been pretty rough, I've got to say.
Now, Craig, you are not only an astronomer, an amateur astronomer, maybe you're quasi, almost a professional astronomer. I am curious as to whether or not you own a personal solar telescope. Do you have the ability to look at the sun in white light or in hydrogen alpha light? because looking at the sun with the right kind of equipment is a fascinating thing to do. There's a lot more going on, if you know what I mean. So how much solar observing have you done with what kind of equipment, Craig? KD2CXK, K2LIW, the tech man.
Okay, well, yes, I do have various solar telescopes. I'm able to observe the sun in both zero and plus one, which is white light and a slight amber tint, both considered white light telescopes. There are both Thousand Oaks glass solar filters. I prefer glass over Mylar. I also have a Coronado 60, which is a hydrogen alpha with a tuned main chamber, I have a pressure tuner on that. And I have had calcium K solar telescopes in the past. On my wish list is a LUNT. That's LUNT, which is a very, very high quality solar telescope with variable energy rejection filters and pressure chamber tuners. I'll let it drop. There's nothing to see. I mean, it's a ball. There's no activity whatsoever. There's no dramatic coronal prominence. There are no solar ejections. There's really nothing to view except some surface granulation, which is pretty uniform. And corona prominence is minimal. There's nothing spewing off into space of any significance, and unfortunately definitely nothing towards that. To rephrase the question, it's not more of what do we do, Dick, what do we do, like that, like we're drowning in a ship and, you know, you're the only one who has the intelligence to pull the cord on the life raft. It's more of, you know, are there going to be better bands that are not as as dependent on region layer ionization? I'll let it drop one more time just because I know this machine resets all the time. And the next, you know, I did mention there were two parts to this, you know, not to keep the, you know, you in business and the net moving, but this is actually really something I don't know if anybody's really thought about yet. And that is, if we are going into a deep solar depression where there's not going to be a lot of solar activity, therefore not a lot of ionization, therefore not a lot of propagation characteristics, the noise floor is going to come up to the point where it's barely usable, are we going to start as amateurs shifting towards the higher bands? Because this actually could work out for us. A lot of people have been speculating that the FCC and other agencies around the world are thinking about taking some of our bandwidth and selling them to the highest bidder because things are getting tight upstairs. Does our moving to the higher bands because of lack of usability on the lower bands, does that save that off at all? I mean, that's getting into a political question, but maybe you have some knowledge of that. KD2CXK, back to net control.
Arguably the most progressive guys in ham radio are the microwavers. And a very loose definition of a microwaver is a guy who's using usually 1 gigahertz and above. And if you're a microwaver, and there's one of them per 500 hams, and there's one ham per 500 in the general population, so we're talking about one human being per quarter million in the general population. And there is this group of guys, there is the Dr. Tom Williams, WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, for the last 15 or so years, has a listserv website where these roughly 1,000 total microwavers worldwide communicate with each other. That's one of the most popular places where they do it. If you're a microwaver above 1,000 megahertz, 432 and above, I'm going to call it, you don't give a darn about the ionosphere. It's got almost no effect on you. It does change your Faraday rotation a little bit because the amount of ionization of the ionosphere does create a slight increase or decrease. But because the Faraday rotation decreases as 1 over frequency squared or 1 over frequency cubed, by the time you get up to 1 gig and above, there ain't no ionosphere. There's almost no Faraday rotation. And as such, what gives you long-range propagation, let me drop, is other terrestrial weather systems, whether or not it's raining, whether or not there's a high pressure area over the Midwest makes a big difference. And whether or not you're getting a super refraction phenomenon. Super refraction is where you get a moist layer of air down low, particularly beyond midnight, drier air up high, and as such, the radio wave has a downward bending on microwave frequencies. And when the downward bending follows Earth curvature, that guy that is 500 miles away from you sounds like he's in your backyard on 10 gigahertz. The 10 gigahertz band has a band opening some portion of every single 24-hour day if you live within 200 miles of a major body of water like the Atlantic Ocean. So if you're a progressive guy and you you like high-tech equipment and high-tech propagation and high-tech transmitters and receivers, of all the 27 kinds of ham radio, the microwave ham radio is very desirable. I spent an awful lot of my life there. My best DX on 10 gigahertz is 380 miles, talking to a Rodan, North Carolina. People think 10 gigahertz is, you know, line of sight. My line, from the top of my tower, my line of sight is 30 or 40 miles out. I talked to somebody 380 miles away. And so to delve into the higher bands where the ionosphere doesn't matter anymore is one way to get out from under all this jazz. Let me drop. And arguably, you'll be talking to the people who have higher education, more technical background, more interesting to talk to. When I first got on the 432 band 30 years ago, then there was very little commercial equipment. You had a home brew. So everybody you talked to was home brew. And I had my my card file of 480 3x5 cards of the 480 guys I talked to in, I think it was like 20 states. And so when you establish a QSO with a guy on 432 and you pick his brain for the next hour. So on sideband, talking back and forth. And with the 432 handband, it really it runs between 420 and 450 megacycles. So it's a 30 megacycle wide band. And so you have no QRM per se. You can choose your own private frequency to talk to somebody and chew the fat and pick each other's brain for a long period of time. So I was having so much fun talking to people that I never got a chance to do very much moonbound, never got a chance to use the HF frequency. So there's a lot to be said to move up. Let me drop. You might ask yourself the question, where is the ham radio frontier frequency-wise? You could say that if you plotted a graph where the horizontal axis is frequency and the vertical axis is how much activity there is on those frequency bands, and as you go up and higher in frequency, that frequency of maximum activity drops off at some frequency. Well, 20 years ago, the really progressive guys were on 10 gigahertz, and they seem to go up about 10 times higher in frequency every 1.5 decades. It's almost a another kind of I can't even think of the guy's name right now. The law. What's the name of the law? What was that again?
Moore's law.
Yeah, Moore's law. Every year and a half or something like that, you double the number of lines of code, or you double the number of the transistors in a chip. There's an equivalent of Moore's law for the microwave guys. Right now, the really progressive people are building and testing equipment on 48 and 78 gigahertz. There's a couple of guys on 120 gigs. There's one particular guy, Byron Justin, WA1, I can't think of his call letters right now. ZMX, I think it is. Anyhow, Byron Justin is on, he holds the distance record in the United States for the 243 gigahertz band. And so, and you would think that he could only transmit a signal a couple of miles. No, he's going a hell of a lot further than that. So to go to the higher frequencies has a lot going for it, because it gets you out from under, depending on the ionosphere, and arguably there's a very interesting group of people to talk to, very highly educated people. You start talking to those people and you're going to be fine. You'll be amazed how many times you form weekly schedules with these guys, because one QSO is not enough. You want to talk to that guy for the next couple of months and pick his brain.
Repeater, timeout.
As I said, pick his brain every time you and he come together. So that's another possibility. Of all the solar and lunar observing that you have done, Craig, My crazy question is, how often have you seen an opaque object drift across the solar disk or drift across the lunar disk while you were doing your observing? How often have you seen an opaque object drift across the sun, for instance? KD2CXK, K2RAW in the TechNet.
KD2CXK. Well, it's actually not uncommon. It depends on how long you've observed for. Of course, most of these are communication satellites or weather satellites or something the like, unless, of course, you plan for a transit, which I did, it was 2 years ago. We had a wonderful Venus transit, which was definitely something to view. That was well planned, of course, and I wasn't the only one looking. But it's not uncommon. In fact, you can actually predict it through software apps when you can see that. Most of the time, of course, it is just communications or weather satellites or some other type of satellite up there that does it. It goes by very quickly. It transits the sun in probably about a second. But you think you're seeing things, but, if you know what you're looking for, it is what it is. It's just a dot. You can't resolve solar panels or anything. KD2CXK, back to you, Dick.
Hey, to you, Jeff. Go ahead, Eric. I just wanted to point out, as broadcasters, we have these big giant dishes that we use to see the satellites with. And I've got a program that tells you, or actually you can go to the various different satellite providers, and they will tell you when you will get a sun outage at your specific location. And that's the point in time as the satellite comes within view of the sun, and the sun's noise is enough to kill the satellite's output. So, actually, when it's right there, dead center, and you lose your signal, it lasts about 3 or 4 minutes. That's about it. K2RAW, K2EJ.
I'm going to guess, Eric, that approximately at the vernal equinox around the March 20th and autumnal equinox around September 20th, in that vicinity of date is when you get these solar outages most frequently. Is that true, Eric? K2EJ, K2RAW?
That's correct, Dick. It's different for different satellites, but everybody's not on the same equatorial plane. They're close, but there's minor differences. And, it happens 4 times a year, from what I remember. I'll have to look. Because it comes close, but it's not right dead center, but you still get the sun noise.
Hi, Craig. Of all the things that you've seen drift across the sun, opaque objects, how often have you seen an object drifting across the sun which takes multiple seconds to traverse the sun? How often have you seen that, Craig? KD2CXK, K2RAW?
Only one stick, the Venus transit. I'm more of a nighttime observer. I mean, people like, in ham radio and astronomy have very similar characteristics to their participants, meaning there's a lot of flavor, a lot of different avenues you can take. People touch a bunch of them, but some people eventually, if you're in it long enough, gravitate towards one area. Your case may be, if I may be so bold, microwaves and ultra high frequency ham radio. I did be on 2 meter sideband in HF. Some people may like 160 meter CW. I even know people who are into VLF. Same thing with astronomy. You have people that are strict planetary viewers. They have long refractors. They're like F-15. They spend money on tremendous stability mounts because they split tight double and triple stars. I'll let it drop. That's what they look at. And you have, of course, you have people who are deep sky objects, or what we refer to as faint fuzzies. They do Messier hunting. They like to look at globular clusters and planetary nebula and galaxies. Very, very faint things. They opt for very wide mirrors. Light buckets, we call them, big Dobsonians where you have to climb up on 8 and 10 foot ladders to look in the eyepiece. Those guys, they love real dark stuff. Then, of course, once again, you have astrophotographers, don't even own an eyepiece. They stick big CCD chips in there, and they do all their observing from behind two monitors. Same thing is with solar observers. You have these guys that go out there, all they do is they want to look at the sun. They have filters, they have hydrogen alpha setups and so forth. That's their thing. They are definitely looking for those transits. They are definitely looking. They go out there to look for the satellites crossing or planets or what have you. They go bananas on eclipse nights and days. So like we're going to have on August 21st, which I'll be heading possibly to the west to view that amazing feat we'll only see once in 99 years. So, but for me, up until this point, it's just been the Venus. KD2CXK, back to net control.
You said the Venus. I don't know what that means, Craig. Go ahead.
Yes, sir, my mouth was moving too fast. For me, it was just the one Venus transit.
Understand. Now, there's a crazy thing going on here. Lots of people have seen opaque objects go across the surface of the sun or the surface of the moon while they're observing it. And they often say, oh, that's an aircraft, it's a satellite, or whatever. When it comes to satellites, you've got three classes of satellites, LEOs, MEOs, and GEOs. LEOs mean low Earth orbit, MEO, medium Earth orbit, and GEO, geosynchronous Earth orbit. Let's talk about the LEOs first. LEOs are in the vicinity of 180 or so, 200 miles up. International Space Station is a kind of a slightly high LEO, and there are lots of others. The LEOs are moving 17,500 miles an hour, altitude of roughly 180, 200 miles. You go through the mathematics of that, you'll find out it drifts across the surface of the sun, half a degree of beam width, in roughly one-third of a second. It'll happen so fast that if you weren't told exactly when to look, you would never catch it. The MEOs at 10,000-mile altitude are so darn far away from you, and they're not miles in diameter. At that distance, it's going to be an extremely small dot. You're not going to see it. And the synchronous orbit satellites at 22,000 miles, not a chance in the world are you going to see that drift across the sun. So when it comes to objects drifting across the sun, for the ones that you've actually really seen that take multiple seconds to go across the sun, they can't be LEOs, they can't be MEOs because the size is too small, they can't be LEOs because the transit time is too fast, and they can't be GEOs because, again, they're too small. So therefore, there's something else that you're seeing other than Venus. Some of the things that you've seen drift across the sun do not fall into the right timing and size category. There's a little bit of a mystery going on there, Craig.
Repeater, time out.
KD2CXK, K2LIW.
Firstly, nothing I've seen other than Venus has taken multiple seconds to go across the sun. I mean, I have seen things go across the surface of the sun while I'm observing it, and they do happen very, very, very quickly. I mean, you can see them go across, but, you know, it all depends on how much magnification. I mean, are you looking at the sun through a 60-millimeter refractor where the sun is only taking up 5 or 10% of the entire field of view? Or are you looking at it through a much larger telescope with much more magnification where the sun may be taking 70 or 90% of the entire field of view? I prefer the latter. I mean, I do have the hardware or the artillery, as we call it, and you know, I do tend to want to make the sun as large as I can, providing that it is in a synchronized mount, so I can see the most detail. As far as other objects, well, it's hard to say. I do not know what other objects are up there. I will say that any aircraft that goes across would probably be obvious as an aircraft. You would see some level of detail at that magnification to not confuse you, unless, of course, that angle was going away or at some point, or it happened so quickly that maybe there was you were looking at it at the corner of your eye and it happened, and you just said, oh, something went across the surface of the sun, but it could not resolve exactly what it was because you were not paying all that much attention, or let it drop. And of course, the possibility also exists for some level of space debris or rock, but I think those are probably quite remote. Like you said, anything close enough is going to be, you know, that you could resolve. I mean, a rock of that size is, you know, coming across, I'm sure we'd know about it. Anything further away will be too small. Now, if you are enlarging the sun to 85% of your field of view in a, let's say I'm observing it at, I have a 1,000 millimeter native focal length, and I'm putting a 9 millimeter eyepiece in there, roughly should give the sun, I would say, probably fill about 75-80% of my field of view, assuming I'm using a Nagler, which is going to give me about an 80% apparent field of view. That's a lot of sun in the eyepiece. A small satellite far away may be resolved as a very, very, very small dot. So you can't discount that. It also depends on the clarity, the atmosphere, and as we call the overall seeing. So I'm not going to discredit that. The possibility does exist. KD2CXK, back to you, Dick, for clarification.
Yeah, I'm talking about now opaque objects that drift across the sun in multiple seconds, and we're not talking about an infinitesimal dot that can just barely be resolved. I'm talking about something that it might be 1 or 2% of the diameter of the sun, the opaque object, and I'm using an eyepiece where I'm seeing the whole sun simultaneously. You talk to people who have done a lot of solar and lunar observing, spent a lot of hours doing it, where they're seeing most of the sun simultaneously. Almost all of them have seen objects, opaque objects of the sizes that I'm talking about, drifting across the sun, and they easily write it off as saying, oh, it's just a satellite. You go through the mathematics, and a satellite in size and rate does not fit. And I'm amazed that so few people have recognized that. Out of curiosity, Craig, the astronomy forum that's going to take place at Rockland Community College in a month or two, I presume you tend to go to those every year, listen to the lectures, and I guess there's about probably, what, 30, 40, 50 vendors selling astronomy equipment at these I can't think of the name of the get together right now. Over to you, Craig, for some words on that. KQRIW and the Tech Man.
Stick, I make it every year without fail. It's referred to as the Northeast Astronomy Forum, or NEAF for short. It's 2 days. It's, I think, the 12th this year of April. It's at Rockland County Community College. It takes place primarily in the Recreation Building, a.k.a. the Gymnasium. You usually get about 100 or so vendors, between 70 to 100 vendors. You can purchase their equipment. You can purchase new and used. The lectures are fantastic. If you have the patience to sit through all of them, kind of like us, they do ramble on. It's a wonderful thing. If you're even thinking about astronomy or have a curiosity of astronomy, it's a must-go. It's about an hour and a half drive from where most of us, the people will hear us on RF. Definitely worth going. Now, we'll bridge it to our current subject. The Northeast Astronomy Forum in Rockland County Community College is the home, weather permitting, of the largest solar star party in the world. Nick, were you aware of that? KD2CXK, back to net control.
On the two occasions that I've gone to the NEAF, assuming that the weather is appropriate and it's not an overcast day, there's a huge number of guys sitting out in the on the grassy field in front of the college, with their solar telescopes, and you can walk in front of each one of those, get online on each one of those solar telescopes. Some of them are hydrogen alpha, some of them are white light, some of them are calcium, some of them are all kinds of tunable filters that you can put on the eyepiece so that you can look at the sun at various wavelengths. So I think that may be what you're talking about. It goes on all day long on the grassy field in front of the college. Give me some words on that one, Eric. I mean, Craig. KD2CXK, KQRIW, and the price is right for the solar observing.
Yeah, that price would be free. I've brought my solar telescope there on a couple of occasions. I think 2 years ago it was a washout. 2 years ago we had rain both days, it was nothing.
and which is really bad because because a bunch of booths and a bunch of exhibitors there, like Lund and Meat, who now owns Coronado, were bringing some really high-powered artillery and hoping to demo it. People also do dissection spectroscopy, looking at the sun, breaking that up into its signature color bands and wavelengths, which can be viewed through an eyepiece, believe it or not. It's a pretty expensive little wedge that fits into a 2-inch receiver and an eyepiece in a focuser, which allows you to see the color spectrum of the sun and its various beauties. You got to really be a scientist to want to purchase that or work for a university. Those colors don't change, so I guess once you see it once, it's pretty much it. It is also good for viewing other stars with the right, you know, putting it in the right telescope. I highly recommend people go to it. It's a lot of fun. Don't have any other input on those people who see large objects transit the sun for durations over 1 second. I'm not looking, so I can't comment, but anything is possible. Just because we don't have the answer doesn't mean it doesn't exist. KD2CXK, back to net control.
C2LR.
Miss LR, go right ahead. Give us the full call letters and your name, and proceed with your question or comment.
Hi, this is Kay, Alpha Charlie 2, Lima Romeo. I was wondering, I have a couple of questions, and this is such a great conversation. I'm wondering, I know when I'm observing at night, if you're just out under the sky, you can see a meteor every, like maybe 5 an hour. So I'm wondering if the objects you're seeing go across the sky are streaking across the sun, or are they more flapping? Because people, birders, I don't know a lot of birds, but I know some migrate really, really high up, and people see them crossing in front of the sun and in front of the moon. But you would notice, I think, motion. I don't know. I don't observe the sun that much at all, and so I don't know. But I also wanted to ask a spectroscope question, but back to you, Dick, AC2LR.
Go right ahead with your spectroscope question, okay?
I was reading some experiments where, you know, like, if you you make your own little spectroscope, and then you can compare looking at an incandescent light bulb, a fluorescent light bulb, a candle, and then go outside and look at something white that's reflecting sunlight, they'll all have different bands. And the sunlight view, when you're looking at sunlight, there'll be black bands interspersed in the color streaks, which they say is atmospheric interference. So you know, say, nitrogen is blocking at this wavelength or oxygen. But if we have atmosphere everywhere, so if you're looking at a light bulb, even from 10 feet away, shouldn't some of the air be absorbing the light spectrum as well? AT2LR.
I'm going to be passing this over to Craig. When you're looking at a light bulb with your instrumentation in your backyard, you're looking through a couple of feet of air. And the absorption lines of air under that circumstance are very, very slight. Whereas when you're looking through 6 miles of air, I'm just saying that the atmosphere has a thickness of 6 miles. I picked a number out of the air, depending on what your definition of atmosphere is. When you're looking through 6 miles of air, you obviously see the blue color of the sky, for instance. That blue color is the individual air molecules are smaller than the wavelength of the light you're looking at from the sun, and therefore they give you what's called a Rayleigh scattering, or a Meade scattering. Anyhow, when an object that's opaque or reflective is smaller than the wavelength of the light you're looking at, it has more effect on the high end of the spectrum. So the high end of the spectrum is blue versus red. That's the reason the sky is blue. So the sun has emission lines and absorption lines in the solar atmosphere itself. I think that they dominate over the absorption lines of our Earth's atmosphere. That's my guess, but Craig's going to correct us on all of that. KD2CXK, K2LAZ, go ahead, Craig.
Okay, well, first of all, yeah, if you're referring to absorption lines or Fraunhofer lines, as they're referred to, you're not going to see any masking at 6 or 10 or even 200 feet.
And of course, unless you're doing it in a very, very bad day in London or any day in Beijing or Hyderabad. However, when you're looking at something high up in the atmosphere or something through the atmosphere, they are going to influence. You're going to see everything from, nitrogen absorption lines, oxygen, and all the junk we've been pumping in the atmosphere if your equipment is sensitive enough. Oh, and there's one more thing that crossed my mind. I'm going to give you, back to the trans unidentified objects across the surface of the sun through a telescope. Why can't I just throw out the universal rubber stamp government answer, high altitude weather balloon? KD2CXK back into control.
Very, very unlikely, Craig. How many weather balloons are being launched in your area? Quite often enough, these objects, you talk to the people who have seen them, the opaque objects that drift across the sun in multiple seconds tend to be perfectly round objects. Perfectly round, opaque objects. Planets don't fit, satellites don't fit, birds don't fit, airplanes don't fit. When it comes to the combination of transit time and size, there's something else going on here, in my belief. And a certain percentage of people see them. A certain percentage of people say, no, I've never seen them. Or maybe they see them and it just doesn't register, if you know what I mean. So there's a bit of a mystery as I see that. Now, when it comes to the absorption lines of our atmosphere, when you're looking through 6 miles of it, without a doubt, there's around 60 gigahertz, for instance, I think is the very first oxygen absorption line. Around 22 gigahertz is the first water vapor absorption line. And there's a whole lot of others as you go up higher into the microwave and millimeter wave and the sub-millimeter wave frequencies. And when it comes to wavelengths and frequencies, you'd be amazed how many people don't have a warm, fuzzy feeling. Let me drop.
Don't forget eye floaters.
Yeah, but the eye floaters are not round objects. You can easily differentiate an eye floater by flicking your eye left and right and watch that floater move around in 20 ways. So not so likely, in my opinion. What was I about to say? Oh, many of us who are VHF, UHF operators got a warm, fuzzy feeling for what is 600 megahertz. It happens to be around channel 35 frequency region when it comes to UHF television. It's below the 900 meg license-free band, but it's below the 800 meg old-fashioned cellular telephone band. But 600 megacycles, we got a warm, fuzzy feeling as to what it is. Go 1 million times higher in frequency. That's approximately the middle of the optical wavelength, 540 nanometers. So optical frequencies are really super high, roughly a million times higher than 600 megacycles. Gives you a little bit of feeling, or the wavelength of 600 megacycles is in the vicinity of 20 inches. A million times smaller than 20 inches gives you a feeling for what we're talking about wavelength-wise here. You probably have some comments on all of the above, right, Craig? KD2CXK, K2IZW in the TechNet.
Actually, Dick, I'm still pondering on what could possibly be floating by the sun at that altitude that takes more than one fraction of a second. It's really kind of digging into me. I mean, if you said that more than a few people have reported seeing these things, then there's some credibility to this. So I think, the question is either we're missing something, where all these people suffer from the exact same undiagnosed, I don't even want to say schizophrenia or something. I mean, there has to be something there. I mean, it's not, they're not saying that I see dead people or anything like that. They're seeing an object that is kind of, you're saying it has no defined shape. It's a ball or a dot. It's not a cube. It doesn't have wings. Go across the surface of the sun. That takes a few seconds. That's really something. What is it? I'm asking you. I have no idea here. KD2CXK, back to net.
KD2LR.
Go ahead, Kay. Have you ever seen these things? Do you have an explanation? You got it, Kay.
No, I have a wild speculation and a question. When people let go of helium balloons and they float away, how high can they go before they, I guess, squish or pop or something? Back to net.
You can specifically design a balloon that will go to numbers like 100,000 feet, where the atmosphere pressure is so low, the balloon is continuously expanding, that it will pop. You can specifically design a balloon that you know is going to pop at 100,000 feet. A typical helium balloon that we buy at a novelty store, I don't know how high they go. However, there are times when I've seen objects drift across the sun, left to right, top to bottom. When you see something drift across the sun, and when you figure out the angles of what's going on, because you're using a 45-degree mirror on your eyepiece in many cases, and because your scope is doing some inverting, the direction that you see an object move in the eyepiece and the direction that it's really moving in front of the scope, you've got to do some fancy figuring to figure out what's really going on. But if you see an object drift rapidly left to right, or drift rapidly up and down, and it's moving downward, I mean, a helium balloon rising rapidly in front of you a couple of blocks away, yes, that's a possible explanation. Would it really be opaque? Would it really be round? But when you see an object drift vertically downward and takes 5 seconds to go across the surface of the sun, a perfectly round, black, opaque object drifting downward, it's kind of hard to explain that as a helium-filled balloon. KD2CXK, K2RIW, go ahead, Greg.
Except that you're forgetting, if you're looking at the sun through the correct kind of telescope, up could be down and down could be up. Left could be right and right could be left. So that possibility still exists. It depends on how they're looking, at what angle, and what kind of equipment. Are they using a 90-degree mirror? Are they using a 45-degree erecting prism? Are they looking straight through? I mean, there's a lot of possibilities here. Back to helium balloons. The average helium balloon, I mean, I find it very difficult to believe it would even achieve 20,000 feet. But then again, you know, this assumes the quality of the material, how the pressure, how much of its maximum bursting capacity was it filled with. I'm going to say 70% is a good average. Yeah, 25,000, maybe 30,000 if it survived. Mylar balloons are much more durable, but they have to be really underinflated to achieve a very high altitude. Those, theoretically, could probably get to about 70 or 80,000 feet, depending on, of course, you know, how large and how underinflated they were. Does that make sense to you, Dick? KD2CXK, back to net.
D2LR.
Go ahead, Jay.
I know there's a lot of helium balloons that get released because I hear from marine reports what a problem they are. They always end up in the ocean. And when I see them, like if I just see them floating around by the trees, they go up, they go down. It depends which way the wind is traveling at the moment. And they'll travel along a current for a little while. So up high, I don't know about weather currents that well, but maybe that's what's happening. If it is a balloon, you're seeing the weather currents push it around. Back to the net.
Yeah, the way a person uses a 45-degree mirror on his eyepiece, it's convenient to the way the scope is aimed. I mean, in many cases, you're looking at an object where the scope is aimed 45 degrees above the horizon, and you're sitting in a chair behind, let's say, a Schmidt-Cassegrain telescope, and you're using a 45-degree mirror coming off the optical tube assembly, and the eyepiece is at right angles to the back surface of the telescope. And now you can twist that whole assembly clockwise or counterclockwise, depending on whether your chair is on the right side or the left side of the telescope. So there's a lot of crazy angles going on here. And depending on what kind of an eyepiece you're using, what kind of a erecting mirror you're using, there's a kind of a 45-degree mirror you can buy, which makes everything come out just right with your Schmidt-Cassegrain telescope. I own one of these things, where, in other words, left and right and up and down is exactly right. Because I use my telescope for doing terrestrial viewing. quite often I will look at the top of my tower with my 8-inch diameter telescope, and even though I might be slant range 200 feet away from the top of the tower, I can easily resolve the threads of a screw, so to speak, and I can study all the hardware up there and decide the next time I climb the tower what tools am I going to bring with me in order to do the next service mission. And so a telescope to do terrestrial viewing, if I happen to be a bird watcher, having this erecting prism would be a very fun thing to do when doing bird watching and other things like that with a telescope. Over to you, Craig. I wonder if you own one of these things that gives you an erect image. KD2CXK, KQIW in the TechNet.
Maybe I have two or three of them in a drawer somewhere. I forgot even which drawers. Listen, nighttime astronomers, visual observers, tend not to want to use an erecting prism. We tend not to want to use prisms at all. First of all, it is a piece of glass, which usually isn't apochromatic quality glass that you are putting in the path of the light. Second thing is, they usually reduce the amount of light that transmits through it. The preference for us is a 97 to 99% dielectric coated first surface mirror, or what we refer to as a star diagonal. So the erecting prism is really only good for terrestrial viewing. Some people, if that's what they have, may choose to use it to view objects that are very low on the horizon. But that's pretty much it, Dick. Back to you.
That makes a lot of sense. And even if you're using your dielectric mirror, 97% reflectivity, depending on how much you have tilted it left or right, and depending on where you're sitting and so on, there are ways of figuring out what you see across the viewable eyepiece, left and right, up and down, and what's really going on in front of the scope. There are ways of figuring that out. And you can easily check that by using your controls on the front of the scope. You can move the scope. If it happens to be a fork-mounted scope, you can independently move it in azimuth and elevation and watch what happens to that star you're looking at across the eyepiece, so you can figure out what's going on. So when you see one of these objects drift across the sun and now you want to repeat the procedure, it's relatively easy, in my opinion, to figure out what really was going on in front of the scope. See what I'm saying there, Craig? KD2CXK, K2IW.
WS2N.
Hi, Craig first, and then we'll go over to Paul. Go ahead, Craig.
Over to subject on astronomy, be without Paul. Okay, well, yeah, of course, it's very easy to figure that out. I mean, but back to the reports of unidentified floating objects across the surface of the sun, unless there's more information, I could come up with 10 questions to ask these people. What were you smoking and what were you drinking might even be on that list. I mean, as silly as that sounds, anything is possible. I do not have enough information to make anything more than a speculation. But yes, of course, if it's an azimuth mount or a fork mount, depending on the type of scope and the type of drive, you have up, down, left, right buttons, which are usually used for rough positioning or fine positioning, depending on the multiplier for the deck and right ascension motors that you put in. If you do not have a go-to mount or computer control mount, you might only have up, down, left, right after you've polar aligned the scope. You mentioned the Schmidt-Cassegrain telescope. The older Meads, the 2040-2080 series Meads, did not have go-to capability. They had a right ascension only or clock drive motor, but they did have fine controls for up, down, left, right, which would help you focus for yourself or for a camera. So they'd be very easy to figure out. That KD2CXK, back to net, and then I guess whoever you want.
WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul. And how much solar and lunar observing have you done?
Very little. Years ago, when I was younger, maybe more, but nothing in the last few decades. The sun, I kept a picture of the sun with the International Space Station crossing it that NASA had put out a while back, about, I don't know, about two or three years ago. And then I understand it occurred again on December, this past December, where you can actually see the shape of the space station, you know. One picture.